Public Radio KMXT is supported by a grant from North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations: Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas & Go at the Y, and Gas & Go at Mill Bay.
It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 42 degrees. There's a light rain falling here and there. Out at the airport, they have 76% humidity, southerly winds at 17 miles per hour, and 10 miles of visibility. Look for showers today and tonight, scattered showers tomorrow. Southerly winds gusting as high as 35 today. High near 45 today, low around 36 overnight tonight. Coming up on the Midday Report, threat of gun violence in a school in Gamble caused a lockdown. The Federal Subsistence Board is considering dramatically curtailing hunting of Western Arctic caribou. Those stories and more after news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. U.S. stocks end the day slightly lower after another U.S. bank fail, the third in 2 months. Regulators closed First Republic Bank, then, as NPR's David Gurr reports, J.P. Morgan Chase bought its deposits and most of its assets.
This part of the crisis is over. That's what J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon told Wall Street analysts on a call after J.P. Morgan bought First Republic Bank overnight. Its collapse played out over several weeks after Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank failed. First Republic's efforts to reassure customers and investors didn't work, and in the end, First Republic couldn't find a buyer on its own. Customers withdrew more than $100 billion in deposits, and First Republic's stock sank. Today, J.P. Morgan shares traded higher. David Gura, NPR News, New York.
We see the Dow is down 47 points at 34,050. The S&P was down 1 point. The Nasdaq lost 13. The UN's Food Agency says it is restarting its operations in Sudan, suspended when three of its staff were killed. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports the humanitarian crisis in the country is getting worse by the day, amid fighting between the army and a powerful paramilitary group.
More than 70,000 people have now fled the country. A collapse of the health system has seen thousands injured but without adequate care. Aid operations have shut down and barely any medical supplies have arrived in Sudan, causing growing anger. But the World Food Programme says it has now lifted its 2-week suspension and says it's working to provide life-saving assistance. Only the first shipment of aid supplies arrived in Sudan yesterday, delivered by the International Committee of the Red Cross. Meanwhile, the fighting still rages on. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
Columnist E. Jean Carroll was back on the stand today in her civil case against former President Donald Trump, whom she accuses of raping her in the mid-1990s and then publicly lying about it when she disclosed her story decades later. Trump's legal team appeared focused on Carroll's actions in the months following the alleged attack as they attempt to discredit her testimony. Tonight at midnight, the contract between the Hollywood Writers Union and the major studios expires. NPR's Mandalita El Barco reports the Writers Guild of America says they could go on strike if their demands are not met.
TV and film writers say they're ready to hit the picket lines tomorrow morning if a strike is called just after midnight. Negotiators on both sides are working out how much the writers will be compensated for work that shows up on the streaming services, among other issues. Writers say their wages and living conditions are untenable. Studio executives have been stockpiling scripts in case they stop working. The last time writers went on strike in 2007, Hollywood production shut down for 100 days. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
It's NPR.
NPR News es presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. A threat of gun violence at John Apangaluk School in Gamble was made last Thursday, resulting in a student being sent home. The incident resulted in a lockout protocol for students, teachers, staff, and visitors. KNOM's Greg Knight spoke to the district about the incident.
According to Bering Strait School District Chief Administrator Susan Nedza, the student threatened to bring a gun to get out of school.
Student made a comment that they were going to bring a weapon to school to cause a lockdown. So they were not saying that they intended actual violence, but they were saying they were going to bring a weapon to school and that they wanted to cause a lockdown. So this happens at this time of year sometimes nationwide, that people make comments in order to get their school to close for the day because they want a day off.
The doors were locked on Thursday and remained locked on Friday. Students were sent home on Friday at 1 p.m. According to Nedza, a staff member stood by the door to allow people in throughout the day. Open gym was also canceled due to the lockout.
The lockout procedure is to keep teachers and students operating as normal in the school, but to create a barrier to anyone coming into the school that shouldn't.
Nedza says that the lockout protocol is new since the start of the school year. She added that the decision to monitor who comes into the school building during a possible threat is the best way forward and pays attention to every threat, no matter how minor or offhanded.
We're putting in more of a systematic protocol that says anytime a student makes a threat of any sort, whether we might believe it's not real or not that bad or any of the qualifiers that we sometimes think, we're going to follow a protocol.
Nedza added that local law enforcement was on campus investigating the incident. No one was injured, and the incident remains under investigation. The identity of the student that made the threat has not been released. Reporting in Nome, I'm Greg Knight.
The Federal Subsistence Board is considering whether to dramatically curtail hunting to protect an embattled western Arctic caribou herd. Right now, hunters can harvest up to 5 caribou per day on federal lands. A proposed emergency order before the Federal Subsistence Board would cut that limit to 4 western Arctic caribou per year. The emergency proposal would not apply to hunters on state land. Federal officials say the proposal is spurred by concern for the health of the western Arctic herd. Biologist Tom Plank says the herd has shrunk by more than half since its peak in 2003.
The western Arctic caribou herd has continued to decline, and with the most recent estimate being at 164,000 caribou. The proponents are greatly concerned about the precipitous decline and feel that immediate action is needed to slow the decline and prevent the herd from reaching a point of no return.
Plank spoke at an April 26th public hearing on the proposal held in Kotzebue. The Northwest Arctic Regional Advisory Council, a group of residents that advise the federal government on hunting policy, proposed the emergency measure. The western Arctic caribou herd is one of the largest in the world, and until recently was the largest herd in Alaska. According to an advisory group studying the herd, its migration currently stretches across an area roughly the size of California. The herd spends the summer calving months in the North Slope and moves as far south as the Seward Peninsula in the winter. At the hearing, a large majority of those who spoke were critical of the proposed 4 caribou annual limit. Some, like Kotzebue resident and lifelong hunter Roswell Colley-Yoke Schaefer, said the board should focus on caribou hunters from outside the region.
My recommendation is we stop all aerial hunting in the North Slope in our region, period. For the native folks, we're going to have to tighten our belts. We have to not hunt as much as we used to for a while, until we can get the caribou back again.
Many stress the importance of speaking with elders and receiving more input from remote villages who could be most impacted by the change. Several commentators said the 4-caribou limit was unreasonable for hunters caring for a large extended family or other villages. Kotzebue resident Walter Sampson, who gave his initial comments in Inupiaq, was critical of the meeting itself, citing the lack of an interpreter.
We're speaking in English and denying those folks that speak Inupiaq that who do trapping and hunting. But yet we say we went through the process to go through to get those regulations in place.
The board plans to reach a final decision about the caribou harvest regulations at their board meeting on June 8th. Firefighters from all over Alaska gathered in Sitka earlier this month for a conference to learn from international and state fire and arson investigators. But in order to learn how to put a fire out or investigate its source, someone has to start one. This time it was the arson investigators themselves. KCAW's Catherine Rose has this report.
A fire engine idles in the middle of a mostly empty gravel lot. It's parked next to what looks like a freshly constructed tiny home, except the sides of the house have been removed, revealing the contents of each petite room just like a dollhouse. A recliner in one room, a television and a sofa in another, and a pink dog bed on the floor. A small fire starts to crackle behind the recliner. The blaze grows, and soon the house is engulfed in flames. And the people standing around it, including quite a few firefighters, won't put it out right away. They want this house to burn. This is called a burn cell exercise. It's part of a recertification and training course for fire and arson investigators across the state of Alaska. They came to Sitka in mid-April for their annual meeting and to learn about all of the hottest topics in fire today.
Yeah, and a lot of times when you watch the movies, you'll see the guy throw the cigarette down and the whole thing goes up in flames. That's not accurate.
Interesting.
Go figure.
That's Special Agent Dawn Dodsworth. She's one of the leading federal arson investigators in the country. She oversees arson and explosives for much of the West Coast, including Alaska. Dodsworth and her colleagues are the specialists local fire departments can call in if they need help with a complex fire investigation. Throughout the week, they trained attendees on a variety of topics, including a thorough look at what can actually be ignited by a cigarette.
When you're looking at the fire cause, you, as an investigator, want to formulate a bunch of different hypotheses as to how the fire could have started. So the students have been learning what types of substrates the cigarettes can actually ignite versus not, because there's a lot of myths out there, especially in the movies.
Dodsworth has a PhD in forensic science, but she started her journey in a fire hall, like most of the training participants.
I was a firefighter in New Jersey for 10 years. I did 10 years of structural firefighting and then 15 years of wildland firefighting. Mm-hmm. And while I was going to college for my undergraduate degree, I was an intern for ATF in New Jersey. I actually was like, this is the best of both worlds.
She comes to conferences like this one to provide guidance and training, but also to meet the people she could be working with in the event of an emergency in the region.
I mean, these guys really drive everything that we do. As a fire investigator, it's critical for me not only to go out and meet my state and locals, because I don't want to meet them for the first time at the scene of a tragedy.
The firefighters aren't just learning how to stop fires. They're learning how to pick up on subtle details after a fire has occurred to determine the cause. That's what the burn cell exercise was all about. Setting the scene for investigative training. They had to start with a building that was as realistic as possible. Sitka Fire Chief Craig Warren says Dodsworth's team sent them the plans for the structure, and the assistant fire chief spent 2 weeks building it. Then they collected furniture donations from the community.
We try to make the compartment or the room look like a functional room in your house with similar materials. If we were using couches from like 1970, we wouldn't have the burning that we have nowadays, because we didn't have the plastics back then. house fires didn't go up near as fast as they do now.
The instructors then set each cell on fire separately, using a different method for each one, like a cigarette in a waste paper basket, or a Molotov cocktail.
They do this all the time and they're still like kids.
The work they do is far from easy, and it often goes hand in hand with tragedy. But tonight, at the Granite Creek Pit, the mood is lighthearted. The investigators laugh and revel a bit in the process of lighting each flame and the firefighting that's about to happen in a safe, contained environment. As the fire intensifies, cell phone cameras come out. One firefighter smiles and takes a selfie. After a few minutes of burning, firefighters douse the blaze, and a black cloud billows forth out of the cell. Their colleagues cheer them on. Days later in the training, fire investigators will return to the site of the burn cell to examine the charred rooms and try to determine whether the fires were started by a piece of paper stuffed inside a toaster or a sparking laptop battery. But not likely a cigarette tossed in a tub of gasoline. That only works in the movies. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
Representatives from a company seeking to establish a graphite mine in the mountains north of Nome held a community meeting on April 20th to discuss what's happening with the project, its future impact on the city and the port, and employee needs. KNOM's Greg Knight has this story.
Graphite One Alaska, an American subsidiary of Canada's Graphite One Corporation, wants to develop a pit mine at Graphite Creek near Nome. It would be the largest graphite mine in the United States. Mike Schaffner is the senior vice president at Graphite One Alaska. He spoke at the April 20th meeting, saying the company's pre-feasibility study was completed in October 2022 and identified a target of 53,000 tons that could be sent to market each year. But now that the initial study is complete, Schaffner says his company believes the amount of graphite needed by the market is likely to grow.
The pre-feasibility study looked like that would be what the market would be able to consume. But by the time we completed, it's apparent that the market's going to need much more graphite than that.
Graphite is key to the production of lithium-ion batteries. The preliminary study has shown a 24-year lifespan for the mine. The study forecasts that by 2025, total graphite demand could grow to 4.53 million tons, a 59% increase from 2020. According to Schaffner, a host of jobs, including those earmarked for residents of Nome and surrounding communities, will be available starting this summer.
We'll be using about 120 people this summer. Of that, we would hope to hire between 20 and 35 from the local area. Positions from driller helpers to laborers to equipment operators to camp cooks. Over the next 3 years, that would remain about the same. And then if everything goes well, we would hope to start ramping up construction in 2027, 2028.
If the mine is approved, Schaffner says he's hopeful the graphite leaving Nome would bring a substantial amount of barge traffic to the port by 2029. He added that the graphite would be shipped in sealed containers to avoid dust, and the company aims to ship up to 10,000 tons of concentrate at a time, using about 20 barges per year. Nome Port Director Joy Baker says the port can handle the initial projections of outbound graphite.
I could see the Port of Nome and the shipping companies being able to export a portion of the graphite products southbound, and then as they're mine got up to speed, they could easily be bringing up vessels just to take products south, just to export the volumes that they anticipate reaching annually of 200,000 tons.
Graphite One Alaska plans to operate year-round. There is no current road access to the property. The preliminary study says a year-round road connected to one of two highways in the area is considered the most suitable transport option from the mine site. However, the presence of two threatened seal species in the Imaruk Basin and concerns regarding potential impacts to subsistence are worrisome to one community. Gilbert Talktu, the president of the native village of Brevig Mission, says he feels that most residents in his village are against the mine. He says water that might be used for mine operations poses a serious risk to the environment.
If that contaminated water hits any of our streams or creeks, rivers, that could kill off our salmon and sea mammals that use the Muruk Basin for the migratory routes for spawning.
The mayor of Teller, Blanche Okbiak-Garney, says she was skeptical of Graphite One putting in any roads at first, but changed her mind when she observed that it might provide more access to subsistence hunting grounds in the future.
I think if there were road improvements, that would help our community. Right now, we're wishing the road would be open.
Graphite One's next step is a full feasibility study and field work, which is expected to be complete by the end of 2024. At that point, Graphite One would begin applying for permits with an aim to start construction in 2027. Reporting in Nome, I'm Greg Knight.
Support for KMXT comes from GCI. GCI is a participant in the Affordable Connectivity Program, providing qualifying Alaska households entry-level broadband internet. More information at gci.com/ACP.
Some improvement in manufacturing activity. I'm Novosoffo with the Marketplace Minute. The nation's manufacturers picked up hiring in April, according to two separate surveys, which also reported that supplier prices rose. Both trend lines suggest interest rate hikes have yet to cool the economy as much as the Federal Reserve wants. J.P. Morgan has acquired most of First Republic Bank, approximately $92 billion in deposits, after regulators seized the ailing institution. First Republic is now the third bank U.S. regulators have seized since March. Workers held protests in cities across Asia and Europe on this May Day, a holiday marking labor rights. In France, unions again demanded the repeal of a new law raising the country's retirement age to 64. I'm Novosoffo with a Marketplace Minute.
There are many reasons you listen to KMXT, but there's always one that turned you into a loyal fan. Something that made you want to hear more, learn more, even do more. Whatever that is, today is a great day to share it.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the first day of May, the year 2023. May Day. Did you know that the character of May Day in Animal House was actually based on Dan Aykroyd? Sun rose today at 6:18 this morning. It will set again at 9:56 this evening. That will give us 15 hours and 39 minutes of daylight, a gain of 4 minutes and 39 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature was 62 degrees for this date. That was set in 1983. Our record low was 27, set in 2006 and in 2010. Currently 42 degrees. The light rained and it's breezy out at the airport. They are registering southeast winds steady at 24, gusting to 30 miles per hour, 79% humidity, and they're down to 8 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for showers this afternoon, mostly cloudy skies, high near 45, south winds to 20, gusting to 35. For tonight, showers are likely mainly before 6, mostly cloudy skies tonight with a low around 36, and south winds to 20, gusting to 30. For tomorrow, scattered showers before 11 tomorrow morning, isolated showers after that, mostly cloudy skies with a high near 48, south winds to 10. Looking at our local tides, we just had a high tide here on the east side. That happened at 12:04 and was 6.5 feet. Our next tide will be a low tide at 6:15 p.m. of 1 foot. Over on the west side, your high tide will be a few minutes from now at 12:42 p.m. That will be a 10.9 foot tide in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 6:56 p.m. of 1.9 feet. Mariners, here is your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles offshore. Small craft advisory through tomorrow. South winds to 30 knots today, seas to 13 feet. South 25 tonight, seas to 12 feet. And southwest 20 tomorrow, seas to 9 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory through tomorrow. Southeast 30 today, 7-foot seas. For tonight, southeast 25. Becoming south 15 after midnight, seas to 6 feet. And for tomorrow, on our west side, southwest 15, increasing to 25 knots in the afternoon. 4-foot seas, building to 6 feet tomorrow afternoon in the Shelikof. Here are some of the meetings coming up in the Kodiak Island Borough. Tomorrow, the Women's Bay Service Area Board will be having their regular meeting. That's happening at the Women's Bay Fire Hall at 5:30 p.m. On Thursday, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. Next Monday, the Health Facilities Advisory Board will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 3 p.m. And next Wednesday, May 10th, the Planning and Zoning Commission will be having a work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. And, of course, a week from this Thursday, the Assembly will be having a work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. All these meetings are open to the public, and the meeting packets are available at the Kodiak Island Borough website. Contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310 with any questions. The Kodiak City Council will be having a special meeting on Wednesday. That will be happening in the Kodiak Public Library at 12:30 p.m. The meeting is open to the public, and public members are also encouraged to webstream the meeting. The link for that and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. For any other questions, contact the City Clerk at 907-486-8636. The Big Smoked Seafood School is coming up this Thursday and Friday, if you've ever thought about learning how to smoke seafood. And the big news is, if you're a Kodiak Island Borough resident, it's absolutely free. It's happening from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. each day at the Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center Thursday and Friday. The workshop is for Kodiak Island Borough residents interested in smoking and processing fish, including home fish smoking enthusiasts, small smokehouse operators, fishermen interested in direct marketing their fish, and commercial operators. They want to limit the class to 20 participants. It's free for Kodiak Island Borough residents and made possible with funding from the Kodiak Island Borough. But again, that's Thursday and Friday, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. each day at the Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center. This Saturday, it's coming up, the spring plant sale for KMXT. That's happening this next Saturday, May 6th at 1223 West Kuzkop Street, beginning at 10 a.m. You'll find perennials like primroses and poppies, lots of veggie seedlings, as well as shrubs, indoor plants, and more. Call Marion at 907-539-5009 to find out more, or if you have some plants to drop off as a donation. All proceeds go to KMXT, so we thank you in advance. But again, that's next Saturday, beginning at 10 a.m. at 1223 West Kuzkop Street. Do you remember your first memory? What does that memory shape? How does that memory shape who you are? How do you tell that story? The Kodiak History Museum is hosting a storytelling workshop, recalling one's earliest memories, to delve into this idea of one's earliest memories and becoming aware as a person. The workshop is facilitated by Sperry Ash and will be held at the Kodiak History Museum this next Saturday at 10 a.m. to noon. The workshop is free to the public. For more information, call the Kodiak History Museum at 907-486-5920. But again, that's this next Saturday at the Kodiak History Museum, 10 a.m. to noon, and it's completely free. Coming up Saturday, May 13th, at the Kodiak College Benny Benson Building, meet Marissa Trombley from the Alaska Bird Treatment and Learning Center and learn all kinds of things about her amazing feathered friend, Breland, the peregrine falcon. That will be going on 10:30, starting at 10:30 a.m. Marissa will present Breland with a Q&A following. There's going to be a 10:30 to 11:45 bird feeder building, oh, workshop, and from 12 to 12:30, virtual presentation. Marissa will present Vreeland with a Q&A following. Again, that's happening Saturday, May 13th, the Kodiak College Benny Benson Building.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT two times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.